This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And, you know, the few little developments this week in technology. The CES show was out, and Intel's fifth generation Core processors have arrived. It's going to make a big difference in laptops and battery lifetime. And the FAA has allowed their first real estate company to use drones.
Well, that's a big breakthrough because they were not usable for commercial activity, right?
That's right. And your home router may be an inadvertent member of a botnet. In fact, of the botnet that was used to bring down Xbox and PlayStation 2 networks.
Uh-huh.
And so we'll talk about the Lizard Stressor botnet network. And this week we're going to feature the man who made the first fully electronic computer, Colossus, which was used for code breaking during World War II. This would be Tommy Flowers. This was a suggestion from our listeners. And of course, there was a huge, huge mailbag.
Giant.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Boom.
Now, I made sure he was not out in the hallway enjoying a Pall Mall, and he was
That's
where he
right.
needed to be.
That's right. He didn't. What happened to the rest of that champagne last week? Did Mr.
No, it was. I disposed of it properly by, I hate to say this for the people who like champagne, it went down the sink.
Yeah. Okay, that's your story.
And the bottle was discarded off campus.
Yeah, I know, mm-hmm. I know. That's the official story. But I'm thinking that Mr. Big Mouth's name that day was Sink.
Mr. Sink Mouth.
That's right. We got an email from Lauren. Dear Dr. Schertz, Happy New Year. In December, my Apple TV was updated. Since then, the YouTube interface has changed for the worse. Now I can't see any videos in my, I can see very few videos in my favorites category, and the recents list is limited to only 5 items. I don't like this because I lost a lot of history.
Mm-hmm.
When I call AppleCare, they say, well, it's a Google issue. And I can't talk to anybody at Google. What can I do? Is this a configuration issue? Most appreciated. Thanks, Lauren. Well, Lauren, this is the deal. What you had was not an Apple TV update, actually. Your YouTube app, which was running on Apple TV, was updated. And your YouTube app was updated by Google, which is why Apple said it's not our problem, it's Google's problem.
Interesting.
Now, this update, when they came out, and it was released around the 9th of December last year, the update revamped the interface, and so it was very similar to the YouTube application on Xbox One and PlayStation 4. Now, recommendations and subscription handling when you sign up for a YouTube channel are better and easier to do. Now, it also gives you access to YouTube's entire library of content. Here was the issue that YouTube had. The previous app would not play advertisements.
Mm-hmm.
So the only YouTube videos that you could see on the previous apps were videos where the authors had allowed them to be played where advertising could not be displayed, because the authors, of course, make money whenever there's advertising. Now, with the new application, you have the privilege of seeing all the YouTube videos and all of those glorious ads. Now, but what they did do, in fact, and there have been a lot of complaints about it, they did limit the favorites list and the recents list to only 5 items. I mean, I don't know why they did it. They just did. And there have been a lot of complaints. A lot of people have complained about this to Google, and I suspect Google will listen to those complaints eventually and fix that, and it's certainly not worth calling them. I think just contributing to a blog so they know that you don't like it is probably the best thing you can do. Now, one father found a workaround for his daughter. It turned out, because I started looking around, and this guy was pretty clever. His daughter liked to watch Apple TV, and she had an iPad, and she had all kinds of cartoons saved. And so she had all of her cartoons saved, and now all of a sudden, she can't find her favorite cartoons, and her dad's got to go in there and look them up. Same problem you're having, Lauren. So her dad created her own private YouTube channel. This was very clever. So, you know, he created her own private YouTube channel, and all the videos that she liked, she put into her YouTube channel. So now when she goes to her own personal YouTube channel, it's like this complete list of favorites. That is not a bad idea. And then what he said, you have to make certain that you do. Now, what she does, whenever she logs onto the YouTube app with Apple TV or onto the YouTube app with her iPad, you have to make certain that you're logged into both YouTube, which requires you're logged into your Gmail account, but then you also have to be logged into your YouTube account or your YouTube channel. So then if you're on Apple TV and you add something to your YouTube channel, you go to the iPad, it will be there. That was a workaround, which was pretty clever.
Yes.
So you might try that. But you are right. They did make a change to the favorites, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's not a configuration item at all. We got an email from Carl Tyler. Carl is a longtime listener. Dear Dr. Schertz, I recently saw the movie The Imitation Game, which was about Alan Turing in the Enigma machine and how he and his fellow code breakers at Bletchley Park decrypted thousands of messages transmitted by Germans during World War II. One person who I believe played a very important role is Thomas Flowers. He designed the first programmable electronic computer that helped decrypt the Lorenz or Fish machine ciphers. He would be a worthy candidate for Profiles in IT. And, Carl, that is a great suggestion, and we're going to feature him today. I love it when we get suggestions like that from our listeners.
And you shall receive.
Yeah, we love to have suggestions. Because I've done a couple of hundred, it might be 230 profiles in IT. You know, eventually you start, start getting down to the bottom of the barrel. Because you want to have a profile in IT that's got an interesting story.
Right.
You know, some problem that they have.
Alan Turing was an interesting story.
He was an interesting story, yes. Now, Carl went on to say, I listen to a lot of technology and science podcasts due to my commute to and from work, and I look forward to yours more than any other. I sincerely hope you continue this show for a long time. Well, thank you, Carl. We really do appreciate that fact that you're a loyal listener. Now, he also had one other observation. He says, do you realize that the year 2015 is represented in this binary code sequence, which is actually 11 binary digits, 5 ones and a 0, and 5 more ones. So it's actually a symmetric binary code.
Interesting.
5, 1, 0, and 5 more ones. And I checked that out this morning, Carl, and you are right. That, in fact, is 2015. So there you go. That's like great fodder for the cocktail party. So 2015 is 5 ones, and then a 0, and then 5 more ones.
I think it depends on the cocktail party.
It could depend on the cocktail party.
No.
If you're some young guy 20, that may not be a way to pick up a hot date.
Probably not. I wouldn't suggest it.
Okay. You know, maybe that's been my problem all these years. Although I'm not looking, actually, but anyway.
I'm staying way out of this.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. And I think I should just walk back from that cliff.
I think, yes, take a few long steps back.
Okay, we got an email from Wendy in Fairfax. Dear Tech Talk, I love to use Chromecast for Netflix. I'm an Amazon Prime member, and I'd like to use it for Amazon Prime movies, too. Now, how can I do this with my iPhone? There is no casting option for this app. Love the show, Wendy in Fairfax. Well, Wendy, you're right. The Amazon Prime app, which is on your iPhone, does not support Chromecast. There's not that little Chromecast symbol. Remember, Amazon and Google hate each other.
Right.
There is no way in the world that Amazon is going to write an app that supports anything googly at all. And so they're just not going to do it. So now, if you want to cast your Amazon Prime account, you have to do it from within Chromecast, the Chromecast browser. And, of course, the Chromecast browser, you take one tab of the Chromecast browser. You have to put in the Chromecast extension into that browser, into the Chrome browser. And then on the tab, you can click, you're on a tab, then you can click the Chromecast symbol, and whatever is the open tab will be sent to the TV, to the Chromecast. So you can actually, so what you have to do, you have to open up the Chromecast browser. You have to go to the Amazon Prime website, and then you have to cast that to the TV. Now, here is the problem. Okay, if you are, for instance, if you are on, say, a desktop or a laptop, and you bring up the Chrome browser, and then you go to Amazon Prime, Amazon Prime delivers the videos using Microsoft Silverlight. Well, it turns out Amazon doesn't like, or Google doesn't like Microsoft either. So it turns out the Chrome browser will not support Microsoft Silverlight. So you have to go into the Amazon Prime configuration on the website and select Adobe Flash as the delivery method for the videos instead of Microsoft Silverlight. So you could pick Adobe Flash, and then you could play that. You could then cast your Chromecast, your Chrome browser, which is playing Amazon Prime using Adobe Flash. You could send that to your Chromecast device from your laptop or your desktop. Now, here's the problem. Yeah, on your iPhone, the iPhone does not support Flash. So when you switch it to Flash, then the iPhone won't play it.
Huh.
Because, you know, Apple doesn't like Adobe. So what we have are these feuding giants just making it difficult for the regular everyday consumer. So you can send Amazon Prime to your Chromecast, but not from your iPhone. Sorry for the bad news, but Wendy, but you know, at least you can do it from your desktop. Hope that's going to be okay, Wendy.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from Jim in Kansas. Dear Tech Talk, how can I create a memory DVD? I'd like to put pictures of my father and the family to music so I could show them to the family. Now, I've got a Windows laptop. It's probably more difficult than a Mac, but, you know, what are my options? Love the show, Jim in Kansas. Well, Jim, the good news is this is a relatively easy task. You're going to have a read-write DVD player. Now, if your laptop doesn't have one, like mine doesn't have one, because I like it lightweight, you're going to have to get a USB DVD read-write player, which you can get. They're just dirt cheap now. They're less than $100. You might find one for $50. They're just really cheap. And so you want to get that, and you have to get some writable DVDs. Then what you want to do, now you want to make the video. Now what you want to do from your PC menu, go to Programs, and then open the Windows Movie Maker to launch the program. Now the Windows Movie Maker makes movies, and then choose Start New Project. Now from the Import menu on the left side of the screen, import all your digital pictures, MP3s, or any other music from the media player that you want to play in this unit. Import all of that stuff into your workspace. Then all your digital photos and music are you know, if they're already saved in your computer, it's easy. You just import them into the workspace. Now you just drag down all of these pictures to the storyboard. You adjust your time that you want each picture to show. You can actually decide which song you want to have to play. Generally, one song for every 15 pictures works out pretty well. You can set effects like transitions, the beginning, you can put titles and credits. And then after you're done, you just select Publish To, and then you select your I would save it to your hard drive first, actually. Give it a name like Dad's Memories, and then I'd copy that to the DVD. And you've got it. And you've got a memory DVD. My son did this. We had one of my uncles died, and they want to have kind of a memory lane for him. And my son made a DVD, and they played it at the house all day, so put it in a loop. And it was really a nice feature, because then all the pictures had come up with music. So it's a good idea. Great email. Great email, Jim. We got an email from Leslie in Oakton. Dear Tech Talk, Sometimes I get a little excited, and I hold the button down too long when taking pictures on my iPhone. And then I take a burst of pictures. You ever done that, Jim?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then I take a burst of pictures. Now, how can I save an individual photo from that image burst? You know, what I mean, now I got this like 10 pictures.
Right.
And if I delete them, I delete all of them. But I just want to keep one.
That's a good point.
What can I do? Love the show, Leslie in Oakton. Well, the burst mode, Leslie, is great in some applications. Like suppose you're at a diving competition and your son is up there and he's going to dive and you want to get the perfect view just before he dives, hit it in burst mode and just keep holding it and take about 50 pictures. And then you can, then probably one of those pictures is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to be able just to shoot one and make it perfect. So if you got some kind of fast action and you want to be able to go back after the fact and pick the perfect picture, this is what the burst mode is for. Now, what you can do is when you, after you've done the burst mode, it gathers them all together into one location. And so when you go to your pictures, you'll see the one picture, and up in the upper left corner, it will say burst, and it will tell you how many pictures are in the burst. Now, when you're looking at the burst cluster, down at the bottom, there's a button called select. So you click on the select button, and you can scroll through all the pictures horizontally. And if you want to keep one, you just press it and you just highlight the check mark. And so you might go through out of the 30 pictures, you might highlight one or two or three, just whatever you want. And then when you're set, then when you say done, it's going to say, do you want to keep everything or do you want to keep only your favorites? So you say, okay, I only want to keep my favorites. So if you've checked three pictures, it will just save the three pictures. So it's actually a good question, and sometimes I'll get a burst of pictures. And like if you, like for instance on the iPhone, if you want to have the 10-second delay for a selfie, it takes a burst. And there's no way you can stop it.
Huh.
It takes a burst of 10 pictures, so then you've got to go back in there and select which one of the bursts you want. Otherwise, you just eat up a lot of memory with all these extra pictures.
Right.
We got an email from Chow in Indiana. Wow, Chow in Indiana. She hasn't written for a while. Dear Doc and Jim, can you safely delete setup files of programs or updates that you've downloaded from the internet? I got some files over 5 years old. What kind of downloaded setup files or updates are safe to delete and which must remain? Thanks, Chow in Indiana. So Chow's probably running out of hard drive space. She's trying to clean up the files, and you just start accumulating all these downloaded files. Well, let's assume that you've run the setup to install the programs. So if you've used those setup programs and you installed the programs, in fact, you could delete them because they're not needed anymore. The programs have been installed, and the programs will continue to work without them. It's sort of like in the old days you would get a DVD, and you'd click setup, and then from the DVD it would actually you know, unzip them, uncompress them, and then save them into the hard drive and change the configuration. And when you're done, you just remove the DVD. You don't have to leave the setup files around because the program is self-contained. So you could just delete them. That'd be no problem. Now, on the other hand, suppose your hard drive fails and you got to reinstall them. And if you deleted them, you got to go back onto the internet and download them again. Or maybe you get a new computer. Maybe you get a virus on your computer and, you know, you've got to do a clean install. Or you get a new computer and you got something else. So it turns out that many times when you buy a file, a program on the computer, you can download it after you buy it, but the download rights might only be for 20 days. So they might expire. Or maybe you've downloaded an older version and a newer version is out. So when you go back to download it, you can't get the older version, and that might be the version you want. Or maybe the company's gone out of business. So if it's really a program that you may want to install again in the future for the reasons that I gave, it's probably wise to save it. So one method would be to download it, install the program, and then copy the install program to a backup hard drive. And make certain to delete the old versions of that setup program that might be there. So you just have the latest version there so you don't have a cluttered backup area. And then once you've backed that up, just in case you want to reinstall it again, delete it in your current download folder. Then that way you've got a nice clean download folder to work with. Well, that was those are all great emails. We love your emails.
We do.
Now, we want you to send more emails because Mr. Big Voice loves to pick up that mailbag.
He
does. So just email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we will answer your emails either on the air or I might actually answer them directly by old-fashioned email.
There you go. Old-fashioned email.
Yeah, that's right.
Is there a new-fashioned email?
No, not really.
Okay, all right.
Not really.
This is Tech Talk Radio. It's Saturday morning, and you're listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2. Stand by. More of Tech Talk coming right up.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Thomas Harold Flowers, as his mother liked to call him. Thomas Harold Flowers designed the Colossus, which was the world's first programmable all-electronic computer, and it was used to solve encrypted German messages. Now, his friends called him Tommy.
Tommy, yeah. Right.
So Tommy Flowers was born December 22nd, 1905, in London, England. While working as an apprentice in mechanical engineering at the Royal Arsenal, he took evening classes at the University of London to earn a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering. In 1926, he was, I guess, 21 at that time, he joined the telecommunications branch of the General Post Office. You see, in England, the post office runs the phone system.
Really?
Yeah. So the general, so the post office, you think it's a, so they deliver electronic mail as well as snail mail.
Interesting.
So he joined the telecommunications branch of the General Post Office. Now, back even that early, he believed that an all-electronic switching system without relays was possible. You see, in the old telephone switching network, they'd have all these relays that would click, 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 and you'd dial in a number and it would click all these relays and they would make the connection from you to whoever you were calling, and they were all mechanical. He believed that you could replace these relays with basically vacuum tubes. And so he was a big proponent of all electronic switching systems. Now, in 1941, Alan Turing was looking around to get some help on building some computer hardware because he had a big problem he was working on, trying to decrypt the Germans' Enigma codes. And so he went to the General Post Office, the telecommunications branch, because he knew that they were working on relays. So he thought the computer would use relays to make this computer. So he thought it would go to them, and they would be well-equipped to make a relay computer. So he ended up talking to Tommy Flowers, and he asked him to build a decoder for the Enigma machine. And Alan Turing had designed a decoder machine, which he called the Bombay B-O-M-B-E.
Aha.
And it was relay-based. And so, you know, Flowers built it in all relays. But he still believed that you could replace the relay. You see, let me explain why you could replace a relay. See, a relay has three connections. You've got the two connections that come together and have the high current connection. One might be the positive connector and the negative connector, and you bring them together. Then you've got a third connector that actually either closes it or opens it. You'd be sort of like the gate. So you put in a low voltage that is either going to close the relay or open the relay. So it is a device device with three inputs. Now, the reason that you could use a relay for a digital computer is that digital computers are either zeros or ones. So if it's open, it would be a one. If it's closed, it would be a zero, or vice versa. So you see, a relay is a perfect device for dealing with binary information. And so it's a three-input device that is used for this. Now, let's look at a vacuum tube. They were called actually thermionic valves back then. Thermionic valves. Now, why are they called thermionic valves?
Why are they called thermionic valves? Please
because
tell us.
Because the emitter has a coating on it, and you heat it up, and it emits electrons through thermionic emission. And so from one side, so you got an emitter and a collector. So the emitter emits the electrons, and the electrons are collected. So from the emitter to the collector is sort of like the big contacts on the relay. And in between the emitter and connector, they put this screen that they call a grid. And you can put a small voltage on the grid, and you can either stop the electron flow or you can enable it. And so you see a vacuum tube looks a lot like a relay. So he said, if we went with all vacuum tubes or thermionic emitters, it'd be a lot faster because you could switch an electron flow on and off a lot faster than you could close a mechanical gap.
So what you're missing at home is we have this all posted on a blackboard, so you can see how thermionic emission works.
That's right.
But,
so sorry if I'm going. I'm trying not to go off the deep end here, but
no,
I just.
But
had,
it's physics, and I know you're in.
I just had to have an aside. So they built. He actually built some switches that were all electronic for the post office and their telephone system, and they worked. They worked just fine. So he built the relay-based Bombay machine for Alan Turing, and he did all relays because that's what Alan wanted. But when Alan heard him talk about the all-electronic computer, he introduced him to Max Neumann, who was leading the effort to automate the cryptanalysis of the Lorentz cipher. Now, the Lorentz cipher was much more complicated than the Enigma cipher. It was a high-level German cipher generated by a teletypewriter with an inline cipher machine, much, much more complex. And it took a lot more processing power to do it. It was so complicated it couldn't be done manually. So Flowers proposed an electronic system. And he said, it's going to be all electronic. And he said, we're going to use 1,800 thermionic valves, which now we all know are vacuum tubes.
Right.
So the people at Bletchley Park, this is where Alan Turing, they said, people at Bletchley, they said, you've got to be kidding. 1,800 thermionic, that thing's not going to be reliable. They said, we believe in the good old-fashioned mechanical relays. We know that mechanical relays are always going to work. They're always going to work better than vacuum tubes. So this newfangled idea is wacko, and you're wasting a lot of money working on it. So Bletchley Park management, now this is how they said no. They said, well, you know, Tommy, we just encourage you to proceed on this project, but we're just not going to fund it. but we encourage you to proceed on it as much as you can without funding. So they said yes, but it was really no. So Tommy went back to his office in Dulles Hill, where he was working for the post office. And he started working on this thing, but he didn't have any money, so he just started using his own money to build it. So he started buying the parts with his own funding, and he started building the whole thing himself. And gradually, though, he got the attention of the director there at the post office. His director, his director came down and looked at him. He says, "Well, you know, Tommy, you know, you believe in this so much. You know, even though Bletchley Park is not going to back this thing, I'm going to back it at the post office, and I'm going to let you do it." So even though the Bletchley Park folks who were doing all the decoding stuff wouldn't back it, his director did, and he got priority. He was able to order 1,800 vacuum tubes, which at that time were very expensive, and they were big.
Mm-hmm.
And they built the first machine in 11 months. And this machine was so big.
How big was it?
It was big. They called it Colossus.
Makes sense.
It was Colossus. I mean, it like filled a whole room. And, you know, these vacuum tubes are, you know, were giant vacuum. They're probably 6 inches high, and they got 1,800 of them. They generate a lot of heat. And so it filled the whole room, and it was Colossus. Colossal, so they called it Colossus. That's what the Bletchley Park staff people called it. And the first one was that he built was Mark I, actually. And he only had 1,500 valves, as they say. And it started running November 1943. It was five times faster and more flexible than the system with relays. So he won the bet. And the Bletchley Park people, they said, "Okay, this is looking good now that you built it." So a year later, they moved Colossus over there. Then he built the Mark II Colossus, which had 2,400 vacuum tubes or valves in it.
An even bigger Colossus.
It was a bigger Colossus. And this went to Bletchley Park on June 1st, 1944, and immediately produced some vital information for D-Day. See, if you remember, on D-Day, we had the D-Day invasion at Normandy. And the idea that with the enemy, you don't want to go into the enemy's strength. So actually, Hitler thought that Normandy was such a hard place to attack the coast because of all the cliffs. He said, you know, they're not going to attack here. It's going to be someplace else. And he actually thought that all of the activity in preparing for the invasion of Normandy, he thought it was all bogus. And we were trying to pull him off, and so he would deploy all of his troops to Normandy, and then we would attack someplace else. And so it turned out that they intercepted one of Hitler's messages, and he says, you know, I think these guys are just faking this thing at Normandy. I don't think we should really move any more forces there. Eisenhower read that message that had been decrypted by Mark II Colossus, and he said, tomorrow we attack. And the next day was D-Day.
Wow.
So this actually is a pretty significant piece of equipment. Over the year, the they call them 10 colossi. I guess it's plural. You know, singular is Colossus. So there were 10 colossi completed during World War II in the British decoding efforts. The 11th was ready for commissioning at the end of the war, but was never used. They were all dismantled except for two at the end of the war. And those two ran until 1959 and 1960, respectively. Now, after the war, Flowers was given an award. He was awarded £1,000 by the government. Now, this payment didn't even cover what he had spent of his personal money to start building the equipment. Now, he remained with the post office research station for quite a while. He and his group did pioneering work on all electronic telephone exchanges, which was what he was initially working on. And he did some great work there. He retired in 1969 from... He completed that work by about 1950. In 1964, he moved to Standard Telephone and Cables. He continued working on an electronic switching network for that competitor. He ended up retiring from all of his telecom research in 1969. His work on this highly classified subject was not fully acknowledged until the 70s. He couldn't even talk about it because it was so classified.
Yeah.
Nobody even knew that he had done it. There was a story I read. After the war effort was over, he wanted to build his own vacuum tube machine, and he said, okay, I think I can get a company and build this thing. So he went to the bank, and he wanted to get a loan to build this machine. And the people at the bank said, that is just stupid. A machine like that would never work. Now, he had billed 11 of them, but because it was classified, he couldn't tell the bank that.
Right.
So he didn't get the loan because the bank didn't believe that would actually ever work.
Interesting.
Flowers died in 1998 at age 92, leaving a wife and two sons. So there you go, Thomas Harold Flowers. And, you know, the story of Alan Turing, that was a sad story.
It was a very sad story.
He was, of course, gay, and back in the time then, it was just not allowed. And he was almost viewed as a criminal. And ultimately, the state actions drove him to suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not honored for his accomplishments until much, much later.
Were there some views that maybe he was killed, or was it definitely a suicide? Is there some dispute over how
there,
he did?
There's always a conspiracy theory there.
Mm-hmm.
But
we're all about that here.
Yeah, and so this... So Alan Turing is really a luminary in computer design, computer architecture, computer theory. That's a sad story. But I didn't really know until this week, the whole thing about Tommy Flowers.
Well, it's something interesting. While you're talking about how big this thing was, I went to the interwebs here and Googled it, and I have pictures of it. Did you know that in 1993, there was a move afoot to rebuild Colossus 9, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And so now Colossus 9 exists again in Bletchley Park. And it actually was turned on in 1996, not at the same rate at which mm-hmm. it was originally working at. And Tommy Flowers was there for that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That would have been fun to be at that event.
We're just full of fun stuff.
We are. So there you go. Everything you want to know about Thomas Harold of Flowers, the designer of the Colossus.
We hope you're paying strict attention, because coming up, we're going to ask you to do a schematic of what these thermionic valves look like. I mean, and you might get free dinner out of it. So stand by for the pop quiz here on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. We will be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
For Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to Classroom of the Airwaves.
It's not a radio show.
No, it's not a radio show, so you had to be listening. And, of course, if you're listening and if you're studying and if you're a good student, you're going to learn a few things. And we have to do a learning outcomes assessment that we call a pop quiz.
A test.
Yes. If you get the correct answer to the pop quiz, you'll get two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karim Dining Room. Now, earlier in the show, we were talking about Tommy Flowers. And he, of course, was working at the General Post Office in the telecom branch. And then Alan Turing came there and he said, Tommy, I want you to build a decoder for my blank machine. And what was the name of that machine?
Well, if you know the name of that machine, you need to get it to us quickly. And the best way to do that, I think, really, the best way to do this is to pick up the telephone.
It's a five-letter word, by the way.
Okay, not a blanking machine.
That's right. I'm just getting a clarification here.
Thanks for the sidebar. The number to call, if you're calling from west of London, England, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from our east of our Palatial Limitation Studios in Northwest D.C., it's 877-936-9333. And everybody else, anywhere else, can call us on the wildcard line, which is 877-936-9333. But I'm sure you have some other idea about
Oh yeah, if you want to reach us from the Antarctica and you've got a internet connection, you can reach us on Skype. Simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1 and that will be forwarded to the radio station free of charge. Now, let's talk about the original Colossus had 1500 tubes. Then the second one had 2400 tubes. Now, remember I said a tube had three connections. It had the emitter and the collector and the grid.
Yes, how could I forget?
Those are three, and the grid modulates the current between a emitter and connector. It turns out that instead of having the electrons travel through a vacuum, you can have them travel through silicon, and you can make a transistor.
Mm-hmm.
So a transistor has an emitter, a collector, and a base. It's the same idea. It's just like a vacuum tube, except the electrons travel through silicon, and by varying the voltage on the base, you can vary the current that goes from emitter to collector. It's the same kind of deal. So eventually, vacuum tubes were replaced by transistors. So remember 2,400 vacuum tubes? So the latest chips that Intel is releasing don't have 2,400 transistors. They have about 3 billion transistors. Think about
that. That's amazing.
Think about that. I just wanted to give this comparison. So
mind-blowing.
It is. So now the latest transistors are down are spaced at 14 nanometers, which they're getting closer and closer together. They're stacking them in 3D configurations, and they're getting literally billions of transistors on one CPU. So you can see that the processing power that we have now compared to that Colossus is enormous, even if you just talk about your cell phone. So that was the small thing that I wanted to bring up.
I'm going to throw out a tip here, a hint.
Okay.
Because either the phones are frozen or all the listeners are frozen, or maybe both.
I think the question could have been too hard.
Okay. Well, let's do this. Question A was, what was the name of the blanking machine?
Yes.
Or the blank machine.
Yes.
It's not only the name of a machine, but it's also the name of a place. It's not spelled the same way. So that's hint number one. Why don't you ask a second question? You had another question. And I will make sure.
Oh, yeah. They actually were trying to solve the code from a particular German machine.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the name of that machine?
Well, what was the name of the code?
Yeah, that.
It was either the name of the machine, the original machine.
Or the code.
Or the code. And Andrew, if you will look at the window, I will
there
give
we
you
go.
The, there you
we go. There we go. This is very complicated.
Okay, this is very complicated.
Now,
and we're making it even worse.
Intel's fifth generation core processors have arrived.
Wait a minute.
Hmm?
It's 877-936-9333. We're a disheveled mess this
morning. Oh, we didn't give out the phone.
Well, I gave it out a
second. Hold it.
Wait a minute.
We're waiting for the Skype call. Tech Talk Radio 1.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, that's not working, is it?
No, it's not
working. Okay.
Is this thing on?
Yeah. Okay, now, Intel's fifth generation core processors. We got some serious things we got to cover, Jim.
I'm so sorry.
We got some very, very, very serious things we got to cover here. Intel's fifth generation core processors have arrived. They're codenamed Broadwell. And the chips use 14-nanometer technology, and this is getting closer to the quantum limit. They're getting, the gate size is getting so small. They actually had to kind of go three-dimensional in order to stack them that tightly. And the launch was delayed because of production problems, as you would expect. But finally, they got them launched, and they've been actually shipping at full shipping rates for the last few months. So now these fifth-generation core processors are beginning to come out in laptops and devices, and they were all over the CES show this week. Here's the beauty. The battery lifetime is longer. So, for instance, a typical 15-watt Broadwell CPU will last 90 minutes longer than its predecessor when playing video. So that's good news. It Intel has also added 14 new processors under its Core 3, Core 5, Core 7 designations. It's also expanded its Pentium and Celeron ranges, so everything has been refreshed and updated. The die size shrunk 37%, so it now fits 35% more transistors. For their mobile chips, they've got 1.3 billion transistors,
mm-hmm.
compared to the Colossus of only 2,400 thermionic emitters. Okay, a thermionic emitter is also a vacuum tube. You know, I'm giving you just a little bit of physics. Now, according to Intel, the 3D graphics rendering is improved by as much as 22%.
Mm-hmm.
So the graphics portion of the chip's gotten a boost with Intel's wide-die wireless streaming option that can now stream a full 4K video. So Intel expects this to be in laptops and two by one devices like the Windows Surface machines, in tablets and convertibles, and a number of other what they call power shipping PCs. They began shipping them out in volume a few months ago. So this is the key. If you're about ready to buy a laptop or device, I'd wait.
Wait. Yeah.
I'd wait for to get one of these fifth gen devices. You get a lot better battery power.
Okay. All right. Hey, the phones and the listeners woke up. Okay. We're going to go to lovely Bowie, Maryland, and we're going to talk to Thomas on line one. Thomas, good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning.
Dr. Schertz, please ask question number two. The second question.
Question number two is, what was the name of the code that they were trying to crack in that first machine that Tommy Flowers built for Alan Turing?
The Enigma.
That is correct.
We have a winner. Thank you, Thomas, for listening. And I'm sorry, Dr. Schertz.
Two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room and the Kareem Dining Room. Just stay on the line and give your name and number to Andrew.
Please stay on the line, the POTS line.
Let's stay on the POTS line.
And it would not be the phone line.
That's right.
There you go. Another successful pop quiz.
Yes.
Took a little while, but we got there. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. This is Federal News Radio on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. And we will have more of Tech Talk Radio coming up in just a moment here, right after the break, on Federal News Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn by doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. The Lizard Stressor, a botnet, runs on hacked home routers.
Say that fast.
That's right. The Lizard Stressor. The online attack that was launched late last year by a few criminals who knocked down Sony and Microsoft's gaming networks over the holidays was powered mostly by thousands of hacked home internet browsers, according to KrebsOnSecurity.com. Just days after the attack on Sony and Microsoft, a group of young hoodlums calling themselves the Lizard Squad... The Lizard Squad took responsibility for the attack and announced the whole thing was merely an elaborate commercial for their new service, which was designed to help paying customers knock off their enemies from the internet. And they call it the Lizard Stressor. Now, the service draws on the internet bandwidth from all these hacked routers around the globe that are protected by little more than factory default usernames and passwords. This is a sorry state of affairs. On January 4th, Curbs on Security discovered the location of the malware that powers the botnet. Hard-coded inside of that malware was the location of the Lizard Stressor, a botnet controller, which happens to be situated on the same web address as occupied by the Lizard Stressor website. In addition to turning the infective hosts into attack zombies, the malicious code uses the infected system to scan the internet for additional devices that also allow access via default credentials, such as username admin, password admin, username root, password 12345. So there are some standardized usernames and passwords that are set by default by manufacturers, and some users just don't change them.
Yeah.
And so they can tell the manual, they can ping a device, they can tell what the manufacturer is, and they can
and
just
you know and the they, default is.
They can log right in and then they can own it.
Yikes.
Now for starters, because too many users, you can sort of get it broke. They're just so happy that they've got it working, they don't worry about anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one good thing is, like, you get a Verizon router, it has a fairly complicated password pre-installed. Or if you get one from a cable company or from a telecom. But if you go and buy your own Wi-Fi router, it just comes with the default settings, and you've got to change them. So what you want to do is you want to make certain that you're not running your default username and password. So you want to log into the web browser, which is built into the router, and you can go to there are two addresses that are commonly used, 192.168.1.1. or 192.168.0.1. And I'll put these on the
They're also on the chalkboard over here next to the thermionic valve diagram.
Thermionic valve diagram. So we've got the relay, then the thermionic valve, and then the transistors.
I'm so glad you use different colored chalk because I would be really getting confused right now.
That's right. You know, maybe we're going to have to get an online platform for this radio program. So, you know, like we have like an online, so people can log
you're
in
right.
to the online.
No, that'd
so it's
be
like
great.
A course. It's like an online course, and that we could give a test and everything. Yeah,
I think that'll go real big.
I'm telling you, that really takes the fun out of radio, doesn't
yeah.
it? Oh, we thought you'd just have a
theater
nice, yeah, it's a nice
of the mind.
Nice Saturday morning. Oh no, you got to log
you know,
on and do
log
your homework.
On. Take a look at this. Okay, now everybody's got to. Play along.
So you log on to the web address of your browser, 192.168.1.1 or 192.168.0.1. Okay, some people might be writing this down. So you log on to that, and then you'll come up with a screen that says username and password.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to give a web address where you can look up the default IP addresses for routers.
We really do need a chalkboard now.
Yeah, this particular I'm not going to even attempt to give that one. I'm also going to give in the show outline that'll be posted on Monday.
There you go.
A router of all the a web address where you can get all the router default passwords. So in the event you don't know what yours is, you can always get it. Now, you could always go to the manual and you could look it up.
There's that idea.
Now, so once you've logged onto your router, you want to change your password to something other than the default values. That's the first thing you want to do. The second thing you want to do is probably add encryption. So WPA is the strongest encryption, so you have to put a key in there to activate WPA. Then the WPA2 is the strongest. Then they've got the regular WPA. Then they've got WEP. These are the three levels. WEP is fairly trivial to crack, so I'd recommend going just with WPA2. You just have to put in a longer password, which is harder to remember. So
there you go.
I would certainly do that because the botnet has been causing lots and lots of problems.
We are just going to stay here, Doc, making
okay.
an on-the-fly programming decision.
Well, I
you
think
like that?
I think that's I love this on the fly because we're going to talk about drones.
There
now.
You go.
So that fits right in, don't
uh-huh.
you think? So the FAA is now going to allow their first real estate company to use drones. Douglas Trudeau of Tierra Antigua Realty in Tucson, Arizona, became the first real estate agent who can legally use a drone for real estate photography. Trudeau, the FAA announced, is authorized to fly a Phantom II Vision.
Why? I think I've seen one of those before.
Hey, that is my machine, and I love that machine. And he's going to use it to enhance the academic community awareness and augment real estate listing videos. Now the funny
Reed, he's going to make money out of this.
Here's the funny thing is, I can go to real estate listing videos around the country, and I'm telling you, I got a boatload of real estate agents that are using it without authorization. You just look at their videos.
Mm-hmm.
But at least he's
above
official.
Board.
Okay, in addition, the FAA also granted an exception to the Advanced Aviation Solutions Company in Spokane, Washington, to use a fixed-wing EBAG drone for monitoring crops. They were looking, monitor crops, I guess, see whether they need water or fertilizer or something.
Mm-hmm.
Both Tierra Antigua and Advanced Aviation Solutions can't take their drones for a spin. They're now got a certain rules. In addition to the pilot, there must be an observer. See, now they got rules. If you get, okay, you got a pilot, then you have to have basically a co-pilot for your drone, an observer. And, yeah, also, you can tell this government's involved
here. Oh, you've got to be kidding me.
Then the pilot also has to have an FAA private pilot certificate and a current medical certificate.
Oh, this is ridiculous.
and the drone has to remain within sight at all times. I'm thinking, so you get a license, then I can't go out and fly my drone by myself. I have to have an observer. Then I have to get a private pilot certificate.
You know how expensive that is?
Then I have to get, no, this is a private pilot, FAA private pilot certificate. I mean, it's for a drone, I guess. I guess you have to pass a test or something. You got to get a current medical certificate because they wouldn't want you to pass out while the drone's flying. But that, of course, is why you got your co-pilot right there standing there right with you. So you can tell that this is now government regs are beginning mm-hmm. to creep in.
And there'll be fees.
Yeah. The FAA says it's now received a total of 214 requests for exemption. So there we go. Regulations are beginning to creep into this little area of fun time.
I think you have enough time for Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah. Anonymous was going to avenge Charlie Hebdo attacks. You know, we had 12 people were murdered by some terrorists in this Charlie Hebdo deal. And so Anonymous, which usually goes after businesses, is really upset by this. So in a clip that they came out this week wearing their famous mask, what is this Guy Fawkes mask? Is that, I don't know why it's called Guy Fawkes mask. You know that funny white mask?
Mm-hmm.
So the guy was seated in front of a desk with a hashtag #OpCharlieHebdo, which stands for Operations Charlie Hebdo. And the figure whose voice was obscured said, "We're declaring war on you, the terrorists." He added the group will track down and close all accounts on social networks related to terrorists. They write that freedom of expression has suffered an inhuman insult, and it's our duty to attack. So Anonymous has got them on their radar screen, and they're going to go after them with a denial of service attack and shut down their website. So I think finally Anonymous might be on the right track of something. Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu and make sure to go to the Stratford University website, which would of course be stratford.edu, and tell them that you heard about their programs on Tech Talk Radio.
Hey, if you tuned in late or would like to hear the show again because it was just so much fun the first time, tune in tomorrow for the Tech Talk replay at 7 o'clock. See you next week.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Hockey on the radio later on today. The Caps take on the Detroit Red Wings at the phone booth starting at 6:45 of the pregame show. The puck drops at 7 o'clock. It is going to be sunny and very cold today. Highs in the low 20s right now outside our studios in Northwest. 15 degrees, 10 a.m.